Through his writing, he looks at violence and evil and the nature of man. He is James Dickey. I'm Don Swaim in New York with Crosstalk. Many people will recognize the name James Dickey as a result of the successful novel Deliverance and the motion picture of the same name, but Dickey is best known as a poet. His book, Buck Dancer's Choice, won the National Book Award in 1965. His first book, Into the Stone, was published in 1960. Since then, he's written well more than a dozen books of poetry and criticism, and he served as consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress. Educated at Vanderbilt, Dickey has taught at Rice University, Reed College, San Fernando State, and is now a poet in residence at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. James Dickey, in 1977, you stood on the steps of the Capitol in Washington along with Jimmy Carter and read an inaugural poem, The Strengths of Fields. And to my knowledge, Robert Frost was the only other poet to have been singled out for such an occasion. How did you, as a poet, feel surrounded by all those politicians as you read Strength of Fields?
Well, I felt as though I had been given an opportunity that was, as you say, rare in the history of my country, and I wasn't worried about delivering the poem, really. I was worried whether it was a good poem or not, and because when you got up there in front of the audience at the inaugural gala, which is where it took place, it's too late to worry about that. The words are in the places that in the poem that they're going to be in, and that you've put them in, and you can just forget about changing them around anymore or doing any revision. The time to deliver it is then, and you just get up there and do it the best you can. Try to get to articulate the words so that people will know what the words are.
Have you ever felt that in reading your poem in that particular forum that you might be always politically linked with Jimmy Carter?
I wouldn't mind that either. I don't know that much about politics or the complications of international and internal diplomacy and economics and all of those things. But I do know enough about people to know that if all the presidents of the United States had as much moral character and were as upstanding and genuinely ethical as Jimmy Carter is, the country would be in a lot better shape.
Well, what about the poet and the politician? Robert Lowell actively participated in anti-war marches and rallies, and he even turned down a White House invitation in a very controversial way, and he actively campaigned for Eugene McCarthy for president. What does this sort of activity do for the image of a poet?
I don't know. I think the poet needn't worry all that much about his image one way or the other. His business is to write as well as he can do. All this business of activism and so on is sort of beside the point. The poet has no more stake in that particular game than any other citizen has. The fact that he's a poet doesn't indicate that he has any sort of superior judgment of political meanings or values or outcomes or any of. In fact, in the past, the activities of poets and their pronouncements about political matters have not been notable for their accuracy or value.
Are you political? Do you ever take sides?
Well, I take sides, certainly, but I don't trade on the fact that I write poetry to influence people's opinion one way or the other. Yeah, sure, everybody must take sides. They should.
Of course, unlike Robert Lowell, you did make an appearance at the White House in 1980. I think Mrs. Carter engineered a conference of many of the major poets in the United States. What was that occasion like for you?
It was very pleasant because I got to see people from all over the country that I knew here and there, and admired some of them very much. And also I got to meet a lot of poets and literary people that I had never had an occasion to meet before, and it was pleasant from that standpoint standpoint, but I don't know what good it might have done. It was a nice social occasion. I was glad to see a president of the United States do something like that.
You attended Vanderbilt at the time of James Tate and John Quill Ransom and Robert Penn Warren. I think they were called the Fugitives because they had published a magazine of that title.
No, they were before me. Uh-huh. Were considerably before me. I was a post-war student on the GI Bill. The only one of the old fugitive group that was there when I was there and still active as a teacher was Donald Davidson, who was sort of the bellwether of the fugitives in the agrarian movement at Vanderbilt and was the most outspoken and controversial spokesman for them and so on. He was still there, but he was an old man then and very much embittered by various things that hadn't turned out as he wished them to turn out. And although he was effective as a teacher, you could see that he had been more impressive before. And then, unluckily, I never knew him in those days.
Well, this group was known for its Southern roots and I guess, to a certain degree, a conservative image. But did any of this rub off on you subsequently?
I don't think so. No, I read their writings with great interest, and they're all close friends of mine. They're all dead now, except for Robert Penn Warren. Davidson is dead. John Quill Ransom is dead. Alan Tate, whom I loved very much, is dead. Even the second wave of the Vanderbilt poets, like Randall Jarrell, beginning to go. Randall himself is dead, who was the most brilliant fellow that I personally ever knew anything about or was acquainted with. And, their influence is mainly in books now, really not much through people. As to my connection with them, it was only theoretical. I'm interested in people who are as rebellious as those men were, especially if they're Southerners. And their writings are of great interest to me as a counter thrust to the industrial juggernaut and its the kind of life that it insists on. It brings about the general destruction of the ecological system that industrialism and machine society brings in. All these things the fugitives were against, and I think they have some very powerful arguments against it.
The New York Times gave your last book of poetry, Strength of Fields, a very good review, but I noticed they referred to some of your work as redneck poetry. You mentioned being a Southerner. What, any response to that?
I don't know. I don't know exactly why. I don't use a lot of... I'm not like Billy Carter, who wears a T-shirt that has redneck power on it. I don't... Not really. I don't understand how anybody would make that connection exactly. I would be pleased to have that explained to me.
You covered the Apollo moon... shot for Life magazine. Where will the poet be as the doorway to outer space opens?
I don't know. He'll be wherever he's always been, looking on and interpreting things in his own way for whatever value there may be in it for him or for the people that may read what he writes. Beyond that, I don't believe I could say or anybody else could say where his place is.
A NASA official told me that a petition had been circulated that urging that you be among the first civilians to ride the Columbia Space Shuttle.
Yeah, I would go.
You would go?
Yeah, in a second.
Uh-huh. What would be the point?
Just to be there. Mm-hmm. As they say, it's a rare opportunity. Right. You don't get a chance to do this every day. Mm-hmm. I was flying out to Seattle to have an operation a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, and I happened to be in an airliner at the very minute that Mount St. Helens erupted. And the pilot said, there's nothing wrong with the airplane, but something has happened down below. Mount St. Helens has just erupted, and everybody who wants to see it, go over to the left side of the airplane and look out the window, because you don't get to see this every day. I would feel the same way about flying in a space shuttle. Not very many people do it. I would be happy to do it.
Of course, indeed, you are no stranger to flight. You flew some 100 combat missions in the Pacific.
Well, that was a long time ago.
Well, you won 3 decorations for bravery.
Oh, yeah. Well, they were passing those out. I was not all that brave.
How did your experiences in the Second World War and in Korea affect you as a poet?
Well, the war and the military life generally, I think, were the engendering of my interest in literature and in words and so on. I remember when I was riding down to the flight line, I was in a night fighter squadron, I was going down to the flight line in the Philippines once, and there was sort of a delicate film of dust on the bushes at the side of the road. And I thought to myself, that's very striking looking. Somebody ought to write that down or write about it or take a picture of it or something. And I thought, again, before we got down to the airplanes, I thought, well, maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll write a description of that, and I'll put it in a letter to somebody. And then I thought, no, I won't write it in a letter to somebody. I'll just write it, just to have it, to remember it.
Was this sort of introspection during the war unusual among airmen?
Oh, I think it not as unusual as it as might be thought. The Army is, any sort of a military outfit is very lonely. It's very lonely. Although you're with other people all the time, you're mainly just by yourself with your thoughts and your hopes and what they say in the movies, your hopes and your dreams and fantasies and so on. And I think a person who likes words will naturally gravitate toward incorporating some of these things in language. So I did anyway.
You worked for the advertising firm of McCann Erickson in New York and in Atlanta in the 1950s. And your account, of course, was a major soft drink company.
Yeah.
But I understand from what you have said subsequently that the whole experience has left a very bad taste in your mouth.
Well, in some ways I enjoyed it very much. If I had 8 or 9 lives, I'd like to spend one of them in business. I liked talking to business people and working out their problems with them and trying to come up with an idea that will actually cause people to do something, go and buy a soft drink and so on. But it was just not that important. It was not as important as other things that I felt were important. So after a while, I left advertising. But it's in some ways, I think it was very valuable. For one thing, let's see, the only quotation I can remember from Calvin Coolidge, other than I do not choose to run, is his statement that the business of America is business, which it is. And if you haven't worked in an American business office, if you haven't been in on buying and selling, you really don't know what this country is all about. You must see it from the inside. You must live it. It's not enough to go and observe it and then write about it. You've got to be in it. Your values have got to be theirs, or at least you've got to know what theirs are. And you've got to live by the same set of principles and the same income and the same sets of problems that your co-workers and co-urbanites and suburbanites have to understand it. And you've missed the whole meaning of this country, for better or worse, if you haven't experienced it. And you haven't had your life cast on that particular stream.
Still, James Dickey, I remember reading somewhere that you had accused the advertising agency of selling out and having no integrity.
Oh, no, I don't think I said that exactly, although it's true. It's not really a question of integrity in the same sense that a good one would insist on having it, because you're in the business to sell products and services. You're in the advertising business to do that. That is not only the prime reason you're in it, it's the only reason you're in it. And if you talk about integrity in that context, it's relatively meaningless. If you're told to sell Coca-Cola and the Coca-Cola company wants you to say that it's made out of scrapings of the green cheese of the moon, all you do is figure out the best way to get that in, and you don't really care. If you know that it isn't made of that, it's not really relevant.
James Dickey, poet and novelist, is the guest on Crosstalk. I'm Don Swaim in New York. And I read somewhere that you quit advertising and went on welfare. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did. I was on the Georgia State Unemployment. Which is welfare for $35 a week.
Why? And so why did you do this?
So I could write, and also because I had a Guggenheim Fellowship coming up in a couple of months. Also, if you're on relief, that's another part of the American experience that no one should miss. It's wonderful.
You wouldn't do it again?
No, I'm not. Not at my age now, but I shouldn't have done it at my age then, I suppose, which is 38. But I enjoyed it. You get to meet some extraordinary people standing in those long lines. One fellow wanted me to go. He thought I was as down and out as he was, which is quite true. And he wanted me to go into the police force with him. I actually went down with him to see what you had to do to get to be a policeman in Atlanta. But when my friend was rejected, I didn't pursue the matter any further. Especially since he was rejected because he was a criminal.
Name's Dickie.
Nice fellow you never met.
You're known to be quite a hunter, but not with a gun, but with a bow and arrow, and I believe a blowgun.
I'm not all that good with either one of them, but I like to do it. You could say that.
Killing animals does not offend your sensibilities.
Well, I don't think the deer population of this country is in any danger from my depredations. I can tell you. Mm-hmm. But I enjoy it. I'm sort of having second thoughts about it now because it's not that I object to killing animals. In fact, the hunt is one of the most crucial and exciting things there is to do. Because the industrial encroachment on the environment is doing away with them, not the hunters. The hunters are trying to protect the animals so that they can hunt them. So they're trying to protect the environment. When the environment goes, that's when the animals die.
You actually use a blowgun?
Yeah, I like to. I killed a big water moccasin last month.
Does it have poison?
No. Only the extremely mysterious poison of your own breath.
One of the best passages in your so far only novel, published novel, Deliverance, describes the guitar playing of Drew, along with the banjo playing of the albino mountain boy. Apparently, music, especially banjo and guitar, means a lot to you, doesn't it?
Well, more guitar than banjo. I love bluegrass music. Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody asked me the other day, well, I got such curious, had such a curious approach to rhythm in poetry and meter. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, I don't know really where it comes from, but if a critic were to ask me whether my style, prosodic or rhythmical style, derives more from the English prosodic tradition, the tradition of meter in English, in English poetry, that or the pulse of the folk guitar, which has been more important, I would not be able to answer which is more important. I'd say they were both maybe equally important, but then what is equally?
James Dickie, I understand that you have sworn off alcohol, although you once apparently were a very heavy drinker. What did alcohol do to you?
I don't know. Alcohol, I don't remember it was ever quite that lurid. but most American writers drink, or most writers drink, I think, especially musicians do. And a lot of them combine it with narcotics and various dosages, especially musicians. Again, I don't know. I'm really not a moralist, at least in that area.
In fact, William Styron told me that alcohol, to him, increases the creative process.
Well, no, I think that's a delusion. It certainly was in my case. I think it increases your ability to fool yourself about what you're doing. I'll tell you what it is good for, though. If I were to side with my friend Bill Styron on that point, I would say that it increases your enthusiasm for your work. You want to do it. You're eager to do it. You're more eager to do it when you have had something to drink than you are when you haven't had any. And I think really it's that sense of using it to get you started, because you have delusions of grandeur about how wonderful this new piece is going to be, that will encourage you to go ahead and work on it. Whether it's that wonderful or not, you can be sure, cold sober, that it isn't that wonderful.
But no more booze or James.
Oh, no, I don't like that stuff. I never have liked the taste of it. It tastes like varnish. Not that I've consumed a lot of that, but
You were quite interested in athletics in high school.
Yeah, that was much more to my sort of thing.
You were a football star at Clemson,
star
I believe.
Star is an excessive word to characterize my participation in the game. Personally. I like movement, physical movement. I think that is, in my poetry, is one of the best virtues of it. Something is always moving.
Well, looking back, as you were then, interested in athletics, and as you are now, did you ever have any conception, perhaps, at that time that you might become a poet?
None whatever. No, I would have been the least likely candidate to becoming a poet that you could have found in my class, graduating class of 1941 in North Fulton County High School in Atlanta, Georgia. Mm-hmm. I would have been the least likely.
You had a brief fling at acting by playing the sheriff.
Yeah, very brief, two scenes.
Yeah, that was at the that was at the end of the motion picture version of Deliverance.
Uh-huh. I can't really claim any great credit for that. All I did was play myself dressed up in a sheriff's uniform. Mm-hmm.
You weren't afraid of doing damage to your image as a poet?
No, I thought I was the best thing in it.
How do you feel about the confessional mode of poetry?
I don't much care for that. It's embarrassing to me to read that stuff. Mm-hmm. People depend too much on the reader feeling sorry for them, mm-hmm. and not they move them illegitimately, which is the way of the sentimentalist, mm-hmm. rather than that of the real artist.
It's almost as though you're eavesdropping on.
Yeah,
people.
I don't like people who beat their breasts in front of me and all of that and ask me to participate in my own groveling self-pity.
I must say that for our listeners' benefit, those who perhaps aren't aware of some of the confessional poets, some of the prime ones are Robert Lowell and Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath.
Yeah, Sylvia Plath is a Judy Garland of American poetry, I would say. What? And Anne Sexton is not much better either.
You were also a consultant in poetry at the Library of Congress. What was that experience like?
That's the sort of a job. It's very flexible, and you can make it as difficult and hardworking as you want to, or as easy as you want to. It can be used as sort of as though it was sinecure, or it can be a very very interesting job where you can fill your calendar so full of stuff that you. That is much harder than working in the ad business, mm-hmm. but it's of your own doing.
Mm-hmm. What is the role supposed to accomplish?
Well, generally, it's supposed to be a job in which American culture is preserved and disseminated among the people of this country and also internationally. One of the stipulations, which is firm of the job, is that you each. A consultant take one extended trip abroad, and for example, Frost, when he was in the job, went to Russia, so on, and they kept trying to get somebody, all of them wanted to go to Italy, or they wanted to go to France, they wanted to go to England, and so on, and they could never get anybody to go to Australia and New Zealand and over in that direction, so I took that on, and I went down to New Zealand and to Australia and over to China and to Japan and on around up in that direction. It was for about a month. It was extremely enjoyable.
I suspect that Deliverance made quite a bit of money for you, but I also suspect that poetry doesn't sell too briskly. How does a poet manage to keep afloat financially?
Well, poetry, no matter how much poetry you publish, the general places you publish them in are little magazines, which is in the have this going rate, 50 cents a line, which is, you don't get much. You have to publish a lot of poetry to make a living out of that. And you'd be lucky even to get published in those magazines like the Kenyon Review and so on, which are very discriminating and knowledgeable about the subject and don't take anything and that several extremely sharp minds think is first rate. But there are things like giving readings at colleges or doing consultancy work, serving as judges for contests of various sorts. And they're sort of the spin-off or the residue from one's role as a poet. But even for that, a certain amount of recognition as a poet is necessary for you to have before any college will invite you to come there and read and pay you for doing it.
Jim Stickey, we can't let you leave, of course, without reading a poem, and I understand that you would like to read a poem titled The Voyage of the Needle from your last book of poetry called Strength of Fields.
Yes, okay. It's about my childhood. A lot of poets write about their childhood a good deal, but this is, I think, different from a good many. My mother was an invalid, and my brother Tom and I were extremely active kids. My mother's life depended on her being immobile and not raising her heartbeat. She had angina pectoris. So, and she was consequently a great believer in the warm bath to calm her two rambunctious boys down, but nothing could make us be still except her. She invented a game, and she would get one of us in the tub, an ordinary bathtub, American home, Venetian blinds, and that sort of thing. And she would draw us a hot tub, and we would get in, one of us would get in the tub. And then she would take a piece of toilet paper or Kleenex or something and put it on the water and put an ordinary sewing needle on top of that. And the water would soak through the paper, and the paper would fall away and leave the needle on the surface, just floating on top of the water of the bath, just on surface tension. And the idea was not to cause it to sink. It would be extra still. My mother's buried in a cemetery in Atlanta under sort of a thorn bush. It's a curious-looking plant and so on. And I remember her game with us to get us to calm down and be still in the bath years later after she died as being an example of the way her love worked, her from her invalid position of being a heart patient. This was her way of transferring her concern for us boys to us without ever telling us. The child comes sometimes with his mother's needle and draws a bath with his hand. These are your 50 years of fingers cast down among the hard-driven echoes of tile in the thresholding sound of run water. Here the sun divides light from the Venetian sector of the dark, where you sink through both, and warmly, more slowly than being smoothed and stretched, your bodying barge ripples die. A gauze of thin paper upholds the needle, then soaks like an eyelid and falls, uncontrolling, away. The hung metal voyages alone, like the trembling north nerve of a compass. On surface tension, that magic, like a mother's spell cast in sharp seed in your childhood, in scientific trickery rooted and flowering in elation. It is her brimming other world that rides on the needle's frail lake, on death's precarious membrane, navigating through all slanted latitudes, containing a human body she gave and saved to bear by a spell from physics, this fragile cargo. Mother, you say, I am lying in a transference of joy and glory. Come to me from underground, from under the perilous balance of a thicket of thorns. I lie as unmoving. Bring the needle to breathless harbor somewhere on my body that I may rise and tell. My sex is too deep, my eyes too high for your touch. Oh, let it reach me at the lips' water level. The thorns burst into rain on your wooded grave. The needle plunge through the skin of charmed water and die, that I may speak at last with upbearing magic of this household, weightless as love.
With me on Crosstalk, James Dickey, National Book Award poet and novelist whose latest book is The Strength of Fields. I'm Don Swaim.